Well, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to tonight's public lecture, the Martin White Memorial Lecture. My name is Robert Faulkner. I'm an associate professor in international relations, and I'll be chairing this event tonight. First of all, I want to thank you all for coming tonight on what is a particularly gloomy and dark evening. Today is, of course, day one of the Donald Trump era in American politics, and so I'm grateful to see so many of you here who would have otherwise perhaps wanted to stay at home and hide under the duvet. I wish I could offer you some soothing words about how the world will be all right in the end, but I'm afraid I can't. After all, professional pessimism is one of the occupational hazards of working in international relations, so I have nothing to offer on that front, which is why I think it's far better to get on with the program of tonight's lecture, and let me introduce the topic and our speaker. The Martin White Lecture is held annually in rotation at the LSE, at Sussex University, and at Chatham House. It honors the legacy of a man who quite profoundly influenced and shaped the study of international relations here at the LSE and beyond, and he was a particularly key figure also in the creation of the English School of International Relations. It's a great honor, therefore, to welcome Professor Nicola Phillips as our lecturer tonight and to give the 2016 Martin White Lecture. Nicola is a professor in political economy at Sheffield University, where she's also the head of the politics department. Nicola is no stranger to the LSE. She has long roots here. She was a student in the government department, doing a master's in comparative government. She then went on to do an international relations PhD, being situated in both departments, straddling the IR and the government departments. After that, her early career took her on to posts at Warwick University. Then she moved to Manchester and then finally Sheffield, where she, as I said before, is the head of the department. She's had many visiting appointments, fellowships that have taken her around the world, including, I understand, Canada, Australia. She's currently the chair of the British International Studies Association, BISA, and more recently, earlier this year, she was honored when she was appointed a fellow of the Academy of the Social Sciences. Nicola has shaped the study of international relations and particularly international political economy in important ways. She's been played a key role as editor of IPE journals. She has written widely read textbooks on development, on international political economy. And I think her work, although it is wide-ranging in its scope, is particularly well-known for its emphasis on the aspects of the global political economy that have a direct impact on the lives of people in the global south. That is migration, development, poverty, child labor, and forced labor. These are topics that are important but are all too often ignored in some corners of the discipline. So it is quite fitting that she chose the topic for today's lecture as power and inequality in the global political economy, and I'm very much looking forward to this. Now, before we begin, could you please turn your mobile phones to silent? And those of you who will want to use Twitter throughout the lecture should remember that the hashtag for tonight's talk is LSE White. As usual, there will be a Q&A session after the lecture, so you'll all get a chance to come in, and we'll make sure that we'll have a lively discussion. But now, will you please join me in welcoming Professor Nicola Phillips?
Thank you very much for such a kind introduction, Robert, and good evening. It's a huge honour and a delight to return to the LSE to give this this lecture, and I thank the committee of the Martin White Memorial Trust very warmly for such a generous invitation. Thank you to all of you for making the time to come this evening. I'm aware, of course, that we might have a few other things on our mind today. And I actually have a little bit of form in this area. I was to deliver a public lecture in Lima on the afternoon of the 11th of September 2001, and I was faced with the task of trying to make a lecture on trade in the Americas sound relevant and interesting on that day of all days. I believe I must have failed miserably, and I hope I can do a little bit better this evening. I should, of course, have realized when Peter Wilson got in touch with me exactly a year ago to ask me if I would do this lecture, that the 9th of November might be a significant date. Perhaps it wasn't quite as seared in our minds as it then became over the coming months, but I should perhaps have realized that there might be something else of modest interest, perhaps, to my prospective audience this evening. But I comforted myself to think that perhaps the events of last night, and indeed of 2016 as a whole, and perhaps the last few years, make the task more relevant and urgent than ever of understanding the vast and the varied forms of inequality which have taken form in the contemporary era and which are now so powerfully shaping national, international, and global politics. So I'm grateful to all of you for taking the time to come this evening, and I hope to allow you to leave thinking that it was worth your while. It is perhaps ungracious to start a lecture in honour of as inspiring a figure as Martin White by commenting on what didn't interest him and what one doesn't find in a body of work that has influenced a generation and more of scholarship in international relations. But I, of course, work in the field of global political economy, and it has to be conceded, as Hedley Bull did in the second White lecture that was delivered here in 1976, that White's lack of interest in the economic dimensions of international relations is something for which he was vulnerable to some criticism. There were nevertheless some signs in White's work that as international political economy began to crystallize as a field from the 1970s onwards, he may have become more and more interested in our subject matter. And indeed, intentionally or otherwise, he contributed to an emerging critique of the premises and the architecture of international relations as a discipline that spurred the early pioneers of IPE to attempt to articulate a new field of inquiry based on the marriage between international relations and international economics. White's impatience with the narrowness of IR and his chafing against its disciplinary self-absorption offered an early commitment to the values of inquiry across disciplinary boundaries, a commitment that was espoused vigorously, perhaps not fully realised, by the subdiscipline of international political economy as it developed over the 1970s, 1980s and beyond. White was also strikingly impatient with the state centrism of international relations, affording significant amounts of his attention to the importance of transnational relations that he deemed to be equally central to the study of international society. So when Hedley Bull, in his memorial lecture, complained obliquely that, as he put it, several of the current fashions within the professional debate about international relations at the time were laying claim to the discovery of the importance of transnational relations without acknowledging that White's work had always embraced and recognized them, he was unquestionably taking a swipe at the new international political economists. White's unstinting commitment to fusing international relations scholarship with historical inquiry finds parallels in much of the critical IPE scholarship that emerged from the 1970s onwards, perhaps most significantly in the work of Robert Cox from the 1980s onwards. So for all of these reasons and more, I allow myself a certain presumption in thinking that White's lack of interest in the economics of international relations was more perhaps ostensible than substantive, and I hope he might therefore have approved of your choice of an international political economist as his memorial lecturer so many years later. So to my focus for this evening, which is the ongoing and increasingly vigorous enterprise of understanding the global political economy of inequality. The LSE is, of course, the last place in which one needs to point out that the last few years have seen a flurry of activity on the issue of socioeconomic inequality, notably, of course, in the publication of Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. He documented in vast detail the links between contemporary capitalism and trends in widening global inequality, which some time ago Jan Nedervin-Petersen rightly described as without historical precedent and without conceivable justification, economic, moral, or otherwise, and which are now playing out politically in such seismic and traumatic ways. Piketty's achievement in his book gave expression to an already expansive field of inquiry to which many scholars in this institution have contributed seminal work and which they continue to lead. In IPE specifically, much debate has swirled around the relationship between globalization, inequality, and poverty. And this work has encompassed dynamics at both ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, the dominant trend in the global political economy is the dramatic acceleration of wealth accumulation and wealth concentration, which has caused such a stretching of the spectrum of wealth and poverty among the world's population. The story is well known, and I don't need to rehearse it here, except perhaps just to refer to one arresting figure in a recent report from Oxfam this year, which indicated that as of now, only 62 people own half of the world's assets. On the other end of the spectrum, international organizations tell us that dramatic progress has been made on the alleviation of extreme poverty between 1990 and 2015, estimating that the number of people now living in extreme poverty has fallen by slightly more than half of the 1990 figure to just under 10% of the global population. But these aggregate figures hide the very uneven nature of improvements across the world. Outside China, progress is very patchy, and an overall decline in extreme poverty has not been sufficient to reduce the total number of people living in such conditions, not least because of population growth. But perhaps most significantly, while there has been a drop in extreme poverty, there has been much less progress on poverty in general. And in fact, between 1981 and 2008, the World Bank's figures show that the number of people living between the $1.25 extreme poverty line and the $2 a day poverty line has doubled. And so I'd ask you to hold that thought, because it's particularly relevant to the content of my lecture, and I'll come back to it later. So the critical question for scholars of all relevant disciplines is therefore how these trends came about. And I want to focus my attention in an area in which I think my own field of international political economy has perhaps surprisingly had rather little to say so far. And it's the implications for these trends in socioeconomic inequality of the particular form of industrial organisation that has come to underpin the contemporary global economy, one organised around the structures of what have come to be called global value chains, or the closely related concept of global production networks. The concept of global value chains refers to a pattern of global and regional production, coordinated and controlled by transnational corporations, which is both functionally and geographically fragmented. So very briefly, in the functional fragmentation of the production process, trade is no longer about the international exchange of final goods, but rather about the production of intermediate goods and services, or as two prominent economists put it, trade in tasks. Functional fragmentation is, of course, associated with geographical fragmentation, as lead firms, in the GVC jargon, progressively outsource or offshore productive functions, shaping new global and regional patterns of specialization, and this is the significant point for my lecture this evening, a new global politics of distribution. It's widely accepted that we're now living in what we could call a global value chain world. For one group of observers, not exaggerating, I think, global value chains have become no less than the world economy's backbone and central nervous system. The 2013 World Investment Report that's released by UNCTAD, the United Nations Commission on Trade and Development, now estimates that around 80% of total global trade flows through global value chains that are controlled by transnational corporations. And even if that's a slight overestimate, it's nevertheless a very arresting figure. The International Labour Organization estimates that one in five jobs worldwide is now linked to production in global value chains. One in five jobs. Virtually all of the major international organizations use the concept and the language of global value chains as a core element of their respective strategies in relation to economic development, and national governments are following suit. To the extent that it doesn't seem to be much of an exaggeration to state, as William Milberg and Deborah Winkler have recently, that the goal of industrial upgrading within GVCs, within global value chains, has become nearly synonymous with economic development itself. But the question of the implications of this global value chain world haven't detained scholars of international political economy working in the traditions of international relations and political science to any great extent. And in particular, I'd like to suggest that the debate that surges around global inequalities has not yet grappled sufficiently with its connections to this form of industrial organization. So my focus for this evening is essentially how the global value chain world works and how precisely it contributes to the patterns of social, of socioeconomic inequality that Piketty and others have so compellingly documented. My intention is to demonstrate that inequality is not a bug in the system, as it were, in this global value chain world, but rather that the foundational dynamics of a global economy organized in this manner directly produce these outcomes, on the one hand, and on the other hand, depend on the harnessing of existing socioeconomic inequalities for their ability to thrive. Strands of the global value chain literature have focused on a core dimension of these foundational dynamics, which is that this particular structure of global industrial organization, of global production, is driven at its root by corporate strategies to harness significant global asymmetries of market power in the interests of generating and capturing profit. So in other words, global value chains exist for a reason. They're not accidental. And the reason is that they enable lead firms to mobilize and exploit vastly asymmetrical power relations between firms and other actors within value chains in order to control how, where, and by whom value is created, and how, where, and by whom it is captured. So to this extent, the traditional focus on firms in relation to global value chains takes us some way towards understanding the patterns of wealth distribution and inequalities of socioeconomic conditions that are our interest here. But I'd like to suggest that this is a restricted focus in understanding how inequalities are produced and reproduced in this global value chain world. I want to advance the argument that we need to understand these dynamics as resting on the interactions of three dimensions of asymmetry in the power relations that crystallize in and around global value chains. Asymmetries of market power, first of all, asymmetries of social power, second, and asymmetries of political power, third. And I've depicted these in very stylized and simplified terms on this slide as a triangle of interlocking sets of unequal power relations. And what such a focus does, I hope, is move us towards a more encompassing view of the transnational social, societal, and political dynamics which intersect with market power in order to produce the patterns of socioeconomic inequality that we see being deepened across the world. Now, such an approach opens up an expansive set of questions and an expansive terrain for research, and I think I've got about 32 minutes. So I want to try to bring this to life a bit by taking a microcosm of these dynamics and exploring in, unfortunately brief, necessarily illustrative terms, what this triangle looks like in theory and in practice in the particular arena of labour and labour exploitation in global value chains. And these forms of labour exploitation include the most severe kinds that are associated with forced labour and child labour, which have been a particular interest of mine over recent years. And I hope to convince you that doing so sheds a valuable wide-angle beam on the big questions of power and inequality in the global political economy and helps us to understand how the evolution of global production and global value chains constitute one of the many means by which patterns of socioeconomic inequality are produced. So, the first element of this understanding relates to asymmetries of market power. And this slide tells us, I think, at a single glance, much of what we need to know. It's not my work. I can't claim any credit for it at all. And it's an image that may well be familiar to many people in the room because it's been circulated and reproduced, as I have done, widely, as an arresting representation of where value is created and captured and by whom or what in a particular value chain. What jumps out immediately, of course, is the red. More than half of the total value across the whole of the production process is captured by the lead firm, Apple. Look, by contrast, at the figures for labour costs, and we start to get a clear insight into both the relationship between capital and labour in the global economy and the relative proportions of value that are captured by each. Let me draw your attention next to the comparison between materials and labour, where the costs of materials involved in production are vastly greater than the human input costs associated with labour. And note now the proportion of profits flowing to the principal countries in which the iPhone is produced, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, and other, compared with the profits that flow to a single private company. This slide depicts the range of countries in which iPhone production takes place, and the large number of supplier firms that are involved in the value chain. These are Apple's registered supplier factories occupying the upper tiers of the supply chain. What we don't see here are the thousands and thousands of firms and enterprises involved in production for Apple, involved in production of the iPhone, but which are not Apple's registered suppliers and have no formal relationship at all with Apple. Very often these will be subcontractors to the first, second, third tier suppliers, or informal units operating way down the supply chain in its least visible parts. This map also tells us nothing of where the raw materials for Apple's products come from. And it's notable that these arenas of production are almost always excluded from these kinds of depictions of supply chains, or even very often from firms' own definitions of what their supply chains encompass. And we'll return to that point in just a second. So what we see here is a model of globalized production resting on global value chains. And images like these help us to understand, as I said before, the global value chains are not accidental. They've been purposefully constructed, and the reason is very clear. We've already established that this pattern of production is driven by lead firms seeking to create and harness vast asymmetries of market power in the interests of generating and capturing profit. In a global value chain world, it is firms, not states, that now play the major role in determining what will be produced where and on what terms and what will be traded internationally. So, to a great extent, global patterns of production that were once strongly shaped by the constellation of trade rules and other state policies are now artifacts of value chain governance. And I think it's interesting that while the architects of the neoliberal globalization project envisaged a world of free market competition, what has instead emerged, as a couple of my collaborators have recently put it, has been a highly leveraged form of managed trade in which lead firms control production, not markets or states, and in which the value in the system is captured by the most powerful actors within it. But a key point is that states aren't passive bystanders in this process. To the contrary, in conjunction with powerful corporate interests, they have been the architects of this global value chain world, providing facilitative governance functions ranging across trade policy, development policy, corporate tax policy, competition policy, and many other areas. And the latter, competition policy, is perhaps particularly significant for us this evening, inasmuch as the loosening of competition policy that we've seen across the world reflects the much greater political tolerance of market concentration that's come to prevail in recent years, and the much greater political willingness to accept the high levels of market power that characterize lead firms in global value chains. The ability of actors within global value chains to capture the value created in this context is therefore highly unequal, and we saw that in the pie chart of the breakdown of value capture in the iPhone value chain. And we see as a consequence the trends of massive wealth concentration to which we alluded earlier as a core feature of the global political economy of inequality. So what does this look like in practice? And how does it work? Well, again, I'm synthesizing a vast literature that describes these processes, but the essence is as follows, that creating these market asymmetries rests on securing a structure of production in which firms at the top occupy oligopolistic positions, positions of market dominance, occupied by a very small number of very large firms. And in the lower tiers of production, way down the value chain, it rests on creating very densely populated and highly competitive markets. So such structures enable lead firms to transmit commercial pressures on price and on conditions of supply along the length of the value chain and to maximize the process of value capture by varying these conditions at any point in time to their commercial advantage. And of course, these commercial pressures are absorbed most of all by workers. Producers, suppliers, and employers frequently seek to manage the aggressive cost-cutting pressures transmitted by lead firms through the mechanisms of labour costs and labour practices, particularly in the most price-sensitive and labour-intensive sectors. Supplier strategies are shaped by a perceived imperative to reduce the share represented by labour in input costs, as we saw in the value chain for the iPhone, and enhance their ability to manipulate those costs so as to accommodate commercial conditions characterized by high levels of risk and driven by the imperative of value capture. And so a direct consequence of this imperative is the explosive growth of precarious, insecure, and exploitative work as the hallmark of the contemporary global economy, performed by a highly vulnerable and disenfranchised workforce, which is significantly made up of informal, migrant, contract, and indeed women workers. At the extreme end, across the global economy, the production model relies on the systematic use of forced labour and child labour, and this takes a huge variety of forms in global value chains, essentially designed to make people work harder, for longer, and at less cost in intensely competitive and cost-driven commercial environments. So the incidence of these problems of forced labour and child labour in global value chains should be understood not as aberrant, not simply as deviations from a norm, but as Andrew Crane has put it very aptly, as a coherent management practice on the part of firms responding to commercial pressures in the interests of maintaining or increasing profit and competitiveness. So let's return to where we started with the breakdown of the value chain for the iPhone. I hope to have illuminated briefly how some of this works. The point here is that we know for certain that forced labour, child labour, and other extremely exploitative forms of labour practices are embedded in Apple supply chains and those of other electronics producers. So when we trace labour conditions in the value chain, we encounter the famous or infamous dormitory system in China, where workers are often confined to factories and obliged to live in factory accommodation, not least to facilitate compulsory overtime, and often locked in at night. They work in conditions essentially that in the garments sector we've become used to calling sweatshop conditions. This photo is of a dormitory in an electronics factory not supplying Apple in Taiwan, decked out with netting. And the netting here is for the purposes of preventing workers from successfully committing suicide. We've had a few years now of revelations about the use of forced labour, unpaid student intern labour, child labour in supplier factories for Apple, Samsung, HP, Dell, and other firms. But a focus on value chains invites us to take a step further. Apart from sweatshop-like conditions and instances of forced labour in the factories of Apple's and other manufacturers' suppliers, these kinds of conditions are rife way, way down the value chain in the production of raw materials. In this case, in mining for coltan in the Congo, many of you will know that coltan is one of the main raw materials necessary for the production of mobile phones. We know that coltan mining is strongly associated with human rights abuses and with forced labour, especially in the Congo and other parts of Africa and South America. We know that coltan mining is essentially unregulated and is often illegal or associated with illegal trade and smuggling. And the point is that you don't see much of this on infographics like the one we saw earlier representing Apple's supplier network around the world. So far, we have an insight into the disjuncture between where, how, and by whom or what value is created, and where, how, and by whom or what value is captured in the global economy through the mobilization of these asymmetries of market power. And I've tried to paint a picture here of how commercial dynamics in global value chains create and deepen socioeconomic inequalities across the world through the twin mechanisms, first of all, of facilitating the massive concentration of wealth and power at the top end of the value chain, and the mechanisms of labor exploitation at the bottom. But these inequalities aren't simply outcomes, as they are often understood to be in debates about labour standards. What I've sought to underline here is an insight that's well established in classical theories of political economy, which is that the advance of production depends on a set of prior enabling conditions of inequality. And this brings us to the second dimension of my triangular approach associated with asymmetries of social power. So, how do these asymmetries come about and what forms do they take? Again, this is an extremely expansive terrain for research, and I want to highlight simply three elements which I think are of particular interest for our purposes this evening. The first is a well-recognized structural trend, which many people will already be aware of. It is what was called by Richard Freeman recently the great doubling of the world's labor force as a result of the entry into the global economy of China, India, and the former Soviet bloc nations at the during the 1990s. On the tide of political change in those countries and the accelerating liberalization of the global economy, as well as demographic trends, Freeman estimated that the size of the global labour pool had increased from approximately 1.46 billion workers to 2.93 billion workers in the space of a single decade from the start of the 2000s, generating what he called a global readjustment of labour and capital. The second trend in parallel was, of course, the growing adoption of a policy framework designed to facilitate the liberalization and deregulation processes associated with globalization, condensed into the shorthand of labor flexibilization, which again will be familiar territory to many people in this room, leading essentially to an explosion in casual, precarious work and the celebration of disposability as the core attribute of this new global workforce that I described a short time ago. The core global problem in relation to employment now is not unemployment, but rather underemployment. In a contribution in 1976, Robert Cox identified a new social configuration as being threefold, dominated by a transnational managerial class at the apex, running through a large class of established labour in the middle, in what at the time was beginning to be understood as the primary labour market, to the group of what he called social marginals, who were either excluded from industrial production or integrated into the secondary labour market on the basis of markedly precarious forms of employment. Now, as a result of the trends that I've just mentioned, a proportion of Cox's social marginals may well exist in conditions of exclusion from employment in global production. But a far greater proportion of them are now integrated into it. And I ask you to recall my earlier comment on the International Labour Organization's estimate that one in five jobs worldwide are now connected to global value chains. I also asked you to hold the thought when I mentioned that the recent figures on global poverty indicate a decline in extreme poverty, but a marked bunching up, as the World Bank put it, of the numbers of people living between the $1.25 a day extreme poverty line and the $2 a day poverty line. And this is, to all intents and purposes, the population of the global working poor, a category that orthodox economic and development thinking has long struggled to accommodate, as work in this thinking is envisaged as the route out of poverty and the key to poverty reduction. So the question of marginality in this sense has never been more important, has never been more pronounced, never been more pressing. But the marginality stems as much from the terms of inclusion in global economic activity as from conditions of exclusion from the opportunities that might otherwise have been presented by it. And I and others have worked with the notion of adverse incorporation to understand these patterns and the social power relations that underpin them. The third point that I'd like to bring out briefly relates to the inequalities which stem from migration. We noted earlier on that one of the most important constituencies in this new global labour force is migrant labour. And here, obviously, our interest is particularly in the low-paid, low-skilled segments of the labour force. The dynamics of precarious employment and adverse incorporation are magnified by the particular vulnerabilities of migrant workers, which are, of course, very well documented. Migrant workers lack the power to engage in political action around wages and conditions. They lack the rights and entitlements associated with citizenship or residency. Laws governing immigration or, indeed, internal movements of people also act often to strip the worker of labour protection and welfare protection, to constrain their ability to seek satisfactory working conditions by changing employers, and provide mechanisms that employers can use to manipulate the worker, particularly perhaps when the worker is undocumented, such as the threat of denunciation to the immigration authorities. And forced labour and child labour are strongly, not exclusively, but very strongly associated with patterns of global migration. So we see a very complex nexus of vulnerabilities and inequalities, political, social, and economic, that reinforce the possibilities for the severe forms of labour exploitation that migrant workers are disproportionately likely to encounter in global value chains. And of course, the distressing scenario for us, perhaps particularly today, is that the political direction of travel across the world looks set to deepen this nexus of vulnerabilities, given the toxic political climate that swirls around migration, immigration, and labour in today's world. So we add a second layer to our argument about how asymmetries of social power contribute to the production of inequalities in a global value chain world. And I'd like to take the argument a final step further and return as our starting point to the geographical fragmentation of global production. We've looked briefly at the business case for this kind of model, but we now need to incorporate a more explicit recognition of the politics, the transnational politics, that underpin it, specifically in the terms that we've been talking in here, the asymmetries of political power that understand that underpin the global political economy of inequality. We've already touched on some relevant issues, particularly perhaps in relation to immigration policy and the governance of movement. But I want in this last part of my lecture to focus on the politics of global business and regulation. So, as is well known, alongside the geographical imperatives created by the need to source particular products, especially raw materials, and the pursuit of favourable conditions of supply, the geographical fragmentation of production is driven in large part by the search for many firms in many sectors for permissive regulatory and political environments, particularly in relation to labour and environmental standards. But the point I want to make, or the point I want to draw out, is that it is not simply that these conditions exist and people in firms make locational decisions on that basis. Rather, firms themselves mobilize often vast asymmetries of political power which play in their favor in a global value chain world in order to create those conditions and to ensure that they are maintained. And evidence of these political dynamics abounds. The labor contract law in China in 2008, for instance, increased wages and protections for workers. And a large number of firms responded by moving their operations to sites in countries like Vietnam or Cambodia, where the regulatory environment remained even more permissive and labor costs even lower. We have documented evidence of a substantial increase over time in provisions built into bilateral investment treaties, BITs, to protect the interests of foreign investors, wherein investors are granted exemption from new labor laws or national governments guarantee to pay them compensation should any new labor laws be enacted or amended. A recent body of research associated with the process to produce the United Nations Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights involved a survey of about 90 contracts for large-scale investment projects, which revealed that a majority of those drawn up with non-OECD countries contained exactly those kinds of provisions to insulate or to exempt investor firms from compliance with new social or labour laws, or to facilitate compensation to them from national governments for the costs of complying with existing legislation. Representatives of big business occupy seats in parliaments and Congress around the world. They use lobbying power to secure favourable legislation, and their leverage is very strong over national governments in general, but particularly over those governments whose bargaining power is notably weak within global value chains. In the competition to attract foreign investment and to increase their exports, many developing countries have incentives, therefore, to be the low-cost point in global value chains, and that story is very well known. In turn, it translates into incentives to limit regulatory costs for producers or for investors, as well as to keep wages, in inverted commas, competitive, and to restrict workers' ability to organise, and so on. And enforcement mechanisms remain underdeveloped or not implemented. Ample evidence suggests, for instance, that labour inspection systems are often actively hindered by state authorities. Many national governments stubbornly retain permissive laws on child labour, such as in Bolivia and India. So, in short, transnational corporations themselves push for the very gaps in public governance that are necessary for their business models to thrive, working in tandem with some states or through forms of political compulsion over others. They are then apt, subsequently, to criticise precisely these ostensible governance failures as the source of poor labour and environmental conditions in cases of damaging exposure. And such was the case in the collapse of the Rana Plaza garments factory, a very famous instance, in 2013, in which no fewer than 1,135 people died, and from which the fallout featured a very protracted an undignified scuffle between transnational retailers and the national government of Bangladesh in relation to who bore responsibility for health and safety standards in factories, government, lead firm, or factory owner, and who should be responsible for reparations. And it's striking that that scuffle is ongoing. Arguments about political incentives against regulation are just as relevant in the more advanced economies as in the so-called developing world. And here, of course, political dynamics between governments and big business, as well as ideological affinities between them, have substantially the same outcomes in terms of an overall retraction of regulation. To take an instance that's relevant to our interest in forced labour, you may be aware that in 2014, reports in the Guardian newspaper shed light on the prevalence of slavery in the Thai fishing sector. The UK government response, expressed by David Cameron at the time when he was pressed on whether the government, the UK government, would be urging or obliging UK supermarkets not to source seafood products from Thailand, was that it was for consumers to decide whether or not to buy prawns that had been produced using slave labour in Thailand, and that action by firms should remain entirely voluntary. Needless to say, we haven't seen any significant diminishing of the consumption of Thai prawns in the UK. It later emerged that David Cameron had hosted a Thai billionaire linked to slavery in the Thai fishing sector in an unrecorded visit to Downing Street. The response of the United States government to this exposure of slavery in Thai fishing was to call for a boycott of trade with Thailand, but again, not to call for increased regulation of firms. As I indicated earlier, we have a situation in a global value chain world in which firms, not states, now play the major role in determining what will be produced, where, and on what terms, and what will be traded internationally. But they also now play a major role, perhaps the major role in many contexts, in deciding how production will be regulated, through recourse to the mechanisms, of course, of voluntary corporate social responsibility. And this shift in the global political economy towards private governance and voluntary corporate self-regulation is one that states have played a very active role in propelling. So the consequence is that labour standards and indeed environmental standards in global value chains are largely left to firms to regulate for themselves. At the heart of this model, as Jill Espenshade has very nicely put it, is the relationship not between firms and governments anymore, and certainly, of course, not between firms and workers, but between firms and consumers. And the logic is well established. In this vision, firms are accountable to consumers. The fear of the displeasure of consumers will lead to a generalized disposition among firms to improve labor standards and ensure compliance among their suppliers. In the arena of the governance of labour standards, and particularly in relation to forced labour and child labour and those worst kinds of exploitation, state policies have led, for the most part, to an insistence that firms are best placed to address the problem, and that it is for consumers to apply any real pressure that might be needed to compel them to do so. We know that this model doesn't work. And particularly in addressing the worst violations associated with forced labour as, recalling Andrew Crane's phrase, a management practice in the global economy. And a huge literature on corporate social responsibility has established that despite the length of time in which CSR has been a watchword, non-compliance remains the norm rather than the exception, and change on the ground has been minimal. There are, of course, exceptions. And we must recognise those. There are firms that have engaged in meaningful responsibility and accountability initiatives which have had some positive outcomes. And interestingly, you may be aware that in the process of enacting the UK Modern Slavery Act just now, we saw some businesses themselves agitating for at least an element of government regulation at the time when the government didn't seem to be inclined to provide this as part of the Modern Slavery Act. Inasmuch as those firms perceived a need for a level playing field in terms of minimum labour standards. It's also the case that much more attention has lately been given to the combinations of public and private governance that would be needed to achieve improvements in standards across the world. But the generalisation remains accurate, and it underpins a very compelling critique of the shift to a much greater salience for private governance in the global economy. But this doesn't mean that states and transnational corporations are politically united and serving the same cause, nor does it mean that national states are simply overwhelmed by these asymmetries of political power that crystallize in and around global value chains. Some states are more politically willing to challenge big business than others through regulation or other means. Brazil is a good example. The Brazilian government indeed recently sued the electronics manufacturer Samsung for violations of labor standards in one of its factories in Brazil. Intense political contestation occurs between states and firms as they tussle for control over the terms of production and the value created in the global economy. Tax is, of course, one example of this contestation, and the tax scandals and the political fallout from the tax scandals that we've seen in recent years provides a really interesting insight into the politics of global value chains and the relations between states and business. Another is the tension between business and government in relation to immigration policy and the perceived consequences for labour supply. And indeed, this was a theme not only in the election in the United States recently, but also in the debates that have been going on around Brexit and the management of movement within the European Union. Frequent political battles occur, as I have indicated, over who bears responsibility for instances of forced labour and child labour in the global economy. And there has, in this sense, emerged a politics of blame, where firms are apt to place responsibility on state regulation and blame on its deficiencies. States are apt to insist that these are supply chain issues and therefore the responsibility of firms. Consumers receive appeals from each side, and workers, of course, continue to labour in conditions of systematic exploitation. I started off by saying that the events of last night, of the 23rd of June, and a host of other political moments over the last few years make the issues associated with global inequality more relevant and more pressing than ever. And I say that not simply to justify my lecture on a day where most people's minds might be elsewhere, but because the question of the distributional dynamics of the global political economy I would like to suggest, among the key political questions for the coming years. Questions of disadvantage, alienation, exclusion, all of which we've touched on this evening, are critical to understanding our current political juncture. But a focus on those alienated from globalization and crushed by its distributional dynamics can't capture fully the complexity of the political moment in which we find ourselves. Neither Brexit nor the election result in the United States last night can be reduced simplistically in those terms to the issue of disadvantage, important as it undoubtedly is. The question of for whom the system works is equally relevant. How politically the opportunities are protected for this massive concentration of wealth, power, and advantage of many varied kinds, and how economic, social, and political inequalities can be created and manipulated for that purpose. Inequality in all its forms is, to my mind, unquestionably the defining global problem and increasingly the defining political problem of our age. And as scholars, we must redouble our efforts in contributing to the processes of change that are so urgently needed. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much indeed. For those of you who've been following the lecture on Twitter, you'll see there's already a lot of engagement going on. There's an audience well beyond this room. Of course, I want to get you all involved, but I just wanted to mention that you found some unlikely followers to your lecture. People have commented on your remarks about sweatshop conditions in the electronics industry. There's one tweet that picked up on that point from an account that is called Win a New iPhone 7 Now. So I'm not quite sure how they felt this was a good opportunity to promote the iPhone, but clearly the commodification of free debate has progressed far. All right, let's now perhaps keep the conversation in the room. Could I invite for a show of hands, and there'll be a microphone going around. Yes, indeed. So I'll start here on the left, and then I'll make my way to the right. If you could pass the phone to the gentleman there.
Thank you for your presentation. I have two questions. First, you provided a very interesting insight that how global value chains create the conditions in the countries where they have their factories or their production chain. And you gave the example of how when China regulated their market more, they shifted their factories to Vietnam or the countries which doesn't have that much bargaining power or that much regulations for their own benefit. I was thinking, how does that impact the global inequality? Because when these global chains move from countries which are gaining from the factories and getting more people out of poverty, and they move their factories to more underdeveloped countries like Vietnam or Bangladesh, where there are more people in poverty, doesn't that decrease the global inequality in that sense with that action? My second question is more, you talked about the problem of how there is a downward pressure on wages in countries like Bangladesh, where the competitive advantage of those countries is cheap labor. So my question is, if you are a policymaker in a country like Bangladesh, where your competitive advantage in the global market is your cheap labor, how would you introduce policies which maintains like the competitive advantage at the same time ensures the labor standards and proper wage for the laborers?
Okay, thank you. Well, we've already got two questions there. They're quite closely connected. Do you want to handle those, and then I'll send the mic around the corner?
Okay. Right. I think you've put your finger on one of the really difficult questions about this subject matter, which is, of course, a recognition that global value chains and global production and the establishment of factory operations and other kinds of operations in countries like Vietnam and Cambodia provide opportunities as well. And the argument is often heard that, in a sense, the political incentives that I was talking about to be the low-cost point in global value chains make sense in relation to the developmental imperatives of countries and societies across the world. I don't think that's to be disputed. I think what we need to look at is the terms on which those opportunities have been created and what kinds of opportunities exist. And what I've sought to document is that those opportunities are very often concentrated in the sectors of the economy that are characterized by highly precarious, highly exploitative forms of employment, a strong prevalence of, as it were, underemployment, which contributes to people's insecurity and vulnerability. The payment of wages that are very significantly below what would be needed for subsistence in many cases, extremely frequent violations of labour standards, including forced labour and child labour and so on. And so I think what you're hinting at there is a job better than no job, and are these conditions are governments like the government of Bangladesh, to tie it to your second question, essentially obliged to try to insert themselves into global value chains on this basis in order to provide those kinds of opportunities? I would shift the focus away from what the government of Bangladesh could do to how global value chains function, for whom that system works and how it works, and indicate that this isn't inevitable. It isn't inevitable that we should see such a massive concentration of wealth at the top of value chains and insertion of both countries and people into global value chains on these kinds of bases. So it's a very, very significant policy problem, as you rightly identify, for governments and indeed others, including international organisations working on these issues. Not one that to which there is any kind of simple answer. But what I sought to draw attention to was how it is precisely the ways in which global value chains function and the interests they serve that creates the kinds of problems that we see through value chains in many sectors and in many countries.
Okay, thank you. Could you pass the microphone there in the centre, the gentleman right there? Any other questions from the centre here?
Thank you. So depressing.
I should ask you all, could you please say who you are and then ask your question?
Well, sorry. My name is Michael Blanning. I was an LSE student. And I've got four children, and so that's why I say it's so depressing, the children world our children are going to live in. I have this vision that... in fact, you should have said it's a great day that Mr. Trump has been elected, because it is obvious that there are so many aspects of life that you haven't touched on where globalization and inequality go together. You know, why would a British opera singer get a job these days when consumers can go to the Odeon and watch the Met live from New York, right? That singer in New York has put British opera singers out of work. Right? This globalization goes way beyond even all the many things you've described, and is the only way to rebalance, power between consumers, power between capital and labour, is the putting up of walls. Walls of against capital movement, walls against movement of goods, walls against movement of labour, Brexit, a wall between US and Mexico, and actually, which fundamentally would drive people to reassess their positions in society, not as consumers. After the iPhone, right, the reason why Apple make profit is because people like the iPhone. Now, will we eventually go back to an economy where everybody has to own a Nokia and they can't get access anymore to an iPhone?
Now for the question.
Well, that's the question.
Good. All right.
Is that ultimately where we head?
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Second question. Yes, please. Could you pass down the microphone? Great.
Hi, my name is Himanshu, and I'm studying MBA at Royal Holloway University of London. I just did a case study on Apple in China. So I just came across few interesting figures that companies such as Huawei and local Chinese companies are dominating the market. There's a cutthroat competition in China on prices. So are not these companies, which are global brands such as Apple, they are promoting these things all over the world? What is your view? What is your stand on this thing? Are these companies promoting? Because local companies are literally also into the competition because they have eaten up the share of Apple in China. So they are promoting this thing all over the world. What's your take on this?
Sorry, can I just clarify the question? Are they promoting?
Are they promoting this labor exploitation? Because Chinese companies are also... Mm-hmm. in the fray, especially in China, because Apple is the biggest. China is the biggest market for Apple after the States. So, what's your take? Are they kind of, promoting this thing?
Okay, let's take these two, and then if you could pass the microphone back, thank you.
Okay, in relation to the first question, where are we going? I would not subscribe to the vision that you set out of it might surprise you to know, of what a progressive future looks like. I think that is a progressive future indeed lies in precisely the opposite direction. What this is about is not the need for any kind of retreat from globalism or retreat from globalization. It's about paying attention to the form that globalization takes, the form that neoliberal globalization has taken, if you want to cast it in those terms, and looking at the consequences of it, looking at the new politics of distribution or the political political economy of distribution that our particular form of globalization has implied across different parts of the world. I think a retreat of the kind that you identify is in any case quite simply illogical, given the kind of world that we live in today and what we know about the dynamics of development and well-being across the world. But it is nevertheless a call, quite clearly, for a dramatic reconsideration of how distribution is handled in this kind of context. And what I've sought to place emphasis on is, again, as I said to the previous person, that this isn't inevitable. I mean, it's trite now to say, you know, but globalization isn't inevitable, and we know this. And what I tried to do in my talk was place an emphasis on the fact that these are essentially political questions. And if they are political questions, then there are a variety of political possibilities and political answers and indeed political futures that they can generate. What is very obvious is that what we have at the moment for large swathes of the world's population isn't working and can't work. And understanding why that is, I think, our first task. And then thinking about what can be done about it is the really pressing task for the coming years. There are lots of very interesting proposals already. I mentioned Piketty's book right at the beginning in relation to global taxes on wealth. And it's exactly the kind of debate that we need to be having. Apple in China, are they promoting labour exploitation? I don't think promotion would be the right word. I think possibly what we have seen among companies over the years, perhaps less now than 20 years ago, is a sort of a politics of a blind eye, as it were. It is unquestionably the case, though, that these issues are really difficult for companies like Apple and many others. Supply chains are vastly complex. If you talk to people within companies, they very rightly say that monitoring the entirety of the supply chain across the world is an extremely difficult task. So no, I don't think I would go so far as to say that they are promoting labour exploitation. What I would say is that the kinds of business models that I've outlined as underpinning global value chains lend themselves to labour exploitation, lend themselves to the dynamics of generating and capturing profit, which can result in these kinds of practices, particularly further down value chains as suppliers, producers seek to manage those pressures that I indicated are pushed down the value chain, and to manage the commercial risk that is pushed down down the value chain. So I think it's very much more complex than that. I think there is, in some instances, some very interesting and very worthy work that is going on among companies to try to look at these kinds of problems. But without really quite a fundamental re-examination of the business model, my argument would be that what we can achieve will be modest in comparison with what is needed to deal with the scale of labour exploitation. Mm.
Okay, I've got two questions over there. Barry first, and then Peter.
Thank you, Nicola. Excellent presentation. You've set out the structure very clearly. I want to push you a bit on the politics of this, I suppose, because it seems to me that there's a range of possibilities. At one extreme, you could have just been describing to us a fairly major crisis of capitalism, which will have to result in quite a lot of upheaval and us ending up somewhere else. At the other end, you've talked quite a lot about changes in the regulatory environment. In other words, some kind of political incrementalism aimed at ameliorating the flaws in this, which imply that it's sustainable and can be made to work better. And perhaps in the middle, thinking about Trump again, is that there needs to be a different political form, perhaps not such a democratic political form, if this is going to, if this global value chain economy is going to be sustainable. So I'm a little curious as to
where you are in terms of the political implications of the structural analysis that you've set out.
Thank you. And Peter Wilson.
Thank you very much, Nicola. Really important lecture. This follows on from Barry's question, really. I wonder where the International Labour Organization fits into this picture. It was set up in 1919 precisely to deal with these sorts of questions, and its existence is coterminous, interestingly, with international relations as a field of study.
Mm-hmm. That's a good package there. Politics, global governance, international organization.
Let me take the slightly easier question first and concentrate on the ILO. As I left implicit in my presentation, simply because of time, the ILO is a major force in relation to these to the kinds of issues that I'm talking about. What's notable is that belatedly, the ILO is now initiating a major program of work on global value chains, or what it's choosing to call global supply chains, and really trying to embrace the question of how within these kinds of structures, and this will lead me on to Barry's question, but within these kinds of structures, the governance of labour standards can be managed, can be improved, so as to achieve an overall increase or an improvement in standards across the board. The political difficulties for the ILO are, of course, considerable, in as much as it's an organisation based on a tripartite form of governance. And so the political negotiation between business, labour, and states is something that the ILO is set up to manage. And of course, taking serious or paying serious attention to these kinds of issues in that kind of context is politically difficult. But I think it's very significant that, along with other international organizations, the ILO is now embracing the issue of global value chains as one of its main points of focus for the coming years, and I think that has to be a very positive thing, based exactly as you say on the ILO's commitment to the kind of progressive agenda that would be that would be necessary. In relation to Barry's question, this is something that actually quite literally keeps me awake at night. In terms of what needs to happen in order for this to look different. As I indicated in response to a different question, it's not the last of the three options that you outlined. It's not a retreat from those values of a progressive democratic future. And I think there are dangers that becomes appealing as a way of trying to deal with some of these problems, as indeed we're seeing in the political moments that we've been talking about. I hope that from my presentation it would go without saying that I would consider this to be disastrous, and in relation to the question earlier, that these are very complex problems that can't be solved just by building walls and retreating from progressive or democratic values. I think we are in a situation, though, perhaps not of a crisis of capitalism, but certainly a crisis in the distributional politics that have come to be such a central part of this global value chain world. I think there are very few people at the moment who are thinking in terms of a crisis of capitalism. There are a lot of people, however, who are thinking in terms of a crisis of the particular model, perhaps of neoliberalism, using different terms that we currently have. Political incrementalism isn't going to be enough. It's a starting point, but it isn't going to be enough. And we need, in my view, quite dramatic solutions to some of these problems. And the debate is interesting at the moment about what that might look like. What is clear is that, and I think this again goes to the rejection of the last of your scenarios, is that this cannot be articulated at a national level. National states are simply not capable of producing the forms of governance and the forms of politics that can adequately get to grips with some of these issues. It has to be on a global level. And of course, that's the big challenge, because we don't have the mechanisms or the structures of global governance that would allow us to do something serious in this kind of area. So I do think that it's a dramatic, radical rethinking of the relationship between national politics and global politics in relation to these questions that's going to be needed, which of course is a long-term project and has the capacity to reconfigure completely the nature of the global political economy and the forms that inequality takes within it. So I think I'm somewhere between the first of your two options. Political incrementalism isn't sufficient. But nevertheless, this is fundamentally a question of governance. And I think it's fundamentally a question of this disjuncture between national and global governance, and how the challenges of governing global value chains, governing global production, defy national governance as it's currently articulated and demand new forms of global governance that we don't yet have.
Okay, now, I realize I've been neglecting the upper level here. I've created my own inequality in this debate. So let me redress that immediately, lest you think these are the cheaper seats. They are not. Let's take a few questions up there. Thank you.
Thank you. So to quickly introduce myself, I'm a French former student. Actually, like now I work at EBRD, European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, just nearby. As you can see, the city suit. I will have to ask you like a very precise question that follow up on what you said, governance. What do you think about intellectual property laws and especially protection? Like you were talking about the global value chain itself. Don't you think it will... Okay, it's oriented. Do you think it is biasing the global value chain? And if yes, to which extent and what can we do about it? Thank you.
Could you pass it over there, Martin? Yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm Martin Hirst and I'm a fellow here in the International Relations Department. I wanted to ask about the different models of governance of value chains and how that fits with your analysis. So you talked about Apple, whose supply chain is a buyer-driven supply chain. But of course, of the 80% of trade that's attached to global value chains, quite a large share of that takes place within companies, so in a hierarchical value chain. So there are a couple of implications I can think of that for your analysis. So the first is if we look at an industry like extractives, where quite often the multinational company is a direct employer of the precarious labour rather than through subcontractors, how would that affect your analysis? Secondly, you talked about tax, which made me happy. Precisely the reason why Apple is able to avoid tax is because of the trade that takes place between its own subsidiaries within the red part of your diagram. So how does trade within multinational companies as opposed to with their subcontractors sort of fit into your analysis?
Okay, I'll take another one because we are running out of time. Here in the front, yes please.
Hi, thanks. I was wondering if you'd add in about war and its relation to states and other global institutions and the system, the order that, of the global system in relation to the problem with boundaries of states becoming thinner to some extent, and the problem of, as we've recently seen, with failed states and the effect that has on the value chain within those states. And there's this not very optimistic note about Trump. However, we must consider what has taken place in, around the Mediterranean in relation to that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Take a couple more. And
all right, okay, good. Because we are a bit of our time. I'll take one or two more and then we'll have a big round. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time and your very respectable work. My question is relating to the first question in regards to how these multinationals are making use of the situation in gaining a particular advantage, whether it's in the labor laws or, as my colleague here said, in circumventing the taxation purposes, and also in the Apple case of where they are registered in Ireland and they hardly pay any tax, and also the rise of the Panama Papers that gave the world, like, as you know, the issues of multinationals making use of this taxation havens. Thank you.
There's a theme emerging. Yeah. Intellectual property rights, taxation, and the ability of multinationals to shift production and value around the world where they find it missed. That's about four questions. Should we tackle those? And then I can have one more round. Thank you very much.
Yeah, there is a pattern emerging. I said at the beginning of my lecture that this was an extremely expansive set of questions and an expansive terrain for research. And in 35 minutes, by the time I'd finished my introductory comments, I could only hope to touch on some of the issues that are connected with how value is created and captured in global value chains. And so I'm grateful to all of the people asking questions for filling in the gaps. I think tax is a particularly important one. I'm not an expert on global taxation, but I think in order to understand the mechanics of global value chains and the dynamics of global value chains, one has to be at least an amateur in relation to an understanding of tax, and rely on other people then to bring much more expertise to the question. But all of this clearly goes together. I focused, as I said, on a microcosm relating to labour practices and labour standards. Tax and the governance of tax is, of course, another. I tried to draw attention to the way in which this is an arena of intense political contestation between governments and business in a global value chain world. And I think it's connected with all of the questions that interest me a great deal, that people like Will Milberg and Deborah Winkler have been particularly interesting on, about the financialization of profits and how tax fits into those kinds of questions. And so I think this is clearly an element of this picture that I didn't have time to go into today, but is very important. Similarly with intellectual property rights and the ways that those are connected with the creation and capture of value. And there, again, I'm not an expert on IPRs. I don't claim any particular expertise. But it's I think, territory that's been familiar to us for a long time in the study of transnational corporations, in terms of the distribution of rights over over intellectual property and the consequences that has for value and for profit. Models of governance and trade within corporations, again, spot on. This is... Again, one could talk for hours about the various models of governance within global value chains and their connections then to value and to inequalities. And unfortunately, I think there isn't time to go into that here. I think trade within corporations and hierarchical GVCs are a particularly important element of this. Of this picture. I think also different models of ownership are a particularly important question in relation to whether it is the case, and we still don't know this for certain, whether it is the case that there are very significant differences in terms of the incidence of labour exploitation and the kind of violations that I've been talking about in value chains that are based heavily on subcontracting and very long and complex chains of subcontracted production, as opposed to those where transnational firms are essentially have a much greater degree of ownership over the the structure of the value chain. Evidence suggests that that is the case, that there is a strong connection, and particularly between questions of forced labour and child labour and practices of subcontracting. But a lot more research is needed in that area.
I'd like to get two more voices in, so you'll get the last word anyway.
That's
so,
fine.
But we are short
this.
Of time now,
yes,
and I'm sorry to those that I can't take
of
now.
Course.
I can get just two more in, and then I think we're done. Please, yes, sir.
You mentioned the sub-$2 and the.
Excuse me, sorry, we're down here, I'm afraid.
Thank you again for your talk. My name's Andy Waters. I'm a former student of IP at the University of Warwick. I wanted to get your views on, is it entirely a choice for transnational companies to build and operate the global value chains in the way that you describe, or are there market forces that force them to behave in the way that they do to maximize and concentrate profits, things like public ownership and activist shareholders? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And then at the front.
Hi, my name's Richard. It's really interesting, and I just heard playing devil's advocate a bit, so just wondering how far and how radical do you think the goal should be to reduce poverty and eliminate inequality? And just thinking about maybe unintended consequences, one in terms of would that affect living standards in developed nations and our ability to consume and all of that, and also environmental consequences with if you had a reduction in poverty, would that mean greater consumption and more strain on the environment?
Okay, thank you very much. Nicola, you have 2 minutes.
Gosh. The world in and the future of the world in 2 minutes. I think I can't even attempt that. In relation to the first question, it's perhaps a little bit more manageable. I think I would fall back on arguments that markets are political constructions and they're social constructions. I think you have hit on a really important part of this a set of issues, which is about the pressures on firms and the pressures on particular people within firms, particularly from shareholders, that might often cut against some of the aspirations that particular people within firms have to engage seriously with a corporate responsibility or corporate accountability agenda. And those tensions in the shareholder model are well established and well understood, and I think very significant in thinking about what could be done in relation to corporate social responsibility and corporate accountability in these kinds of areas. Is it a choice? Yes. but that is not to say, of course, that the politics within firms are not fierce in relation to the interests that are being served in particular models of corporate governance. How radical should the goals be? Well, this is the future of the world in now probably about 45 seconds. And I think, you know, the important question here is that there's no silver bullet. And as you rightly say, there are implications of the all of the kinds of solutions that are currently being debated and we hope will continue to be debated over the coming years. And they're not new. They're a very long-standing. If you try to eliminate one set of problems, there is always and everywhere a new set of problems, a new set of consequences, intended or otherwise, that are going to need to be dealt with. But I don't think that should lead us into a defeatist attitude. I think we have to seize the moment to be imaginative about what can be achieved, particularly in relation, as I was saying earlier on in response to Barry's question, to the mechanisms of global governance that we need to try to create in order to deal with these global problems where we have seen, and I hope I showed in my talk briefly and very illustratively, that national governments have not shown themselves to be capable of dealing.
Good, thank you. I'm glad defeatism is off the agenda tonight. I'm very glad that we finish on a high. Therefore, I'm going to abstain from quoting the great Donald to finish off the lecture. So I just want to say, Nicola, wonderful that you've put IP on the Martin White Memorial Lecture Series agenda. It's firmly embedded now in this field. It's been an amazing evening. Thank you so much. And please do join me in thanking Nicola Phillips.